everyone. I'm Roger Michael.
And I'm Lenny Shelton.
I'm a stand-up comic and a host and a former domestic violence counselor.
Yes, and I'm also a stand-up comic or a writer here in L.A. We're both from New York originally. And
so welcome to our very first, very first episode of our podcast, Color Therapy, a mental health podcast for people of color.
Yeah, so we're hoping with this podcast that we will be able to address the concerns that people of color have when it comes to mental health, how maybe the mental health profession doesn't address the needs of people of color.
So a lot of things, you know, we have so many different reasons, but one of the things we wanted to discuss, right, is that oftentimes there's this idea that people of color, we don't really feel sad or depressed, mm-hmm. or there's this like, no matter what happens to us, we have this amazing way of feeling happy through it all, yeah. you know, by the power of our community and our amazing brown skin. Like, do we want to?
That we can just like shuck and jive our way into happiness, basically. Yeah, there's this feeling, I think, in the medical field in general that people of color just have this resilience, mm-hmm. you know.
And what I think is really sad is when we internalize that, you know, when we're like, when we feel that we have to do that. To maintain our identity, you know, we forget that the idea, a lot of it came from the colonial era, from it was a justification for slave trade, for colonialism, all these different things, so white people could feel not so bad about the horrible things they were doing for us, because it's like, no matter, oh, we can whip these people, we could take their freedom, we could do everything, but they have this way of being happy, they're not like us white folks, this would make us unhappy, but they'll be fine. But we were, but being told this for hundreds of years, we've internalized this many ways, we feel like, however sad we are, we feel like we're not allowed to admit it.
Right, right. Yeah, there is a thing in the community of people of color where we feel like we can't admit to each other that we're having these mental health issues, or that, you know, we want to talk to somebody or go to therapy. You know, we feel like, you know, we might be put down or ridiculed, you know.
And then oftentimes when we get there, we do get ridiculed.
Yeah, it does happen. Yeah, it does.
It does happen. So we want to talk about it. But I want to ask you a question. So we're supposed to be happy all the time, no matter what happens. How do you stay happy while there are white supremacists in our country marching and killing people? Right. How do you stay happy in the midst of all this? How does your amazing brown power allow you to be happy in the midst of actual, like, premeditated murder that happened this past week because a white woman, Heather Hayes, was brave enough to stand up against Nazis?
Right. And how do you feel happy when the president is defending the people who are murdering people out there? Yeah. How as a person of color, do you deal with the fact that your elected leader is defending the murder of people who look like you, basically.
Somehow my magic brown power did not kick in. It's not helping me. It's not working out. I don't know. I feel depressed. You know, I'm going to be honest with you.
I tried to sing some old Negro spirituals. It's not working right now.
It was so funny because this white lady that I grew up with, she has good intentions. But she has these very, well, for one thing, I am South Asian, but I'm not Hindu, right? My family is Christian. That's her tradition. But she likes Hinduism, which is nice. It's nice that she has a broad mind and accepts different religions. But we were discussing, and I said, I feel depressed. I'm going to be honest. And she told me, she said, you should call on to the power of Kali, who is a Hindu goddess. She said, you should power. And I was like, how did you make our goddess about your white supremacists? How did you manage to make this leap? Stop giving me advice. You don't know what you're talking about. I was so offended, you know? Like, I didn't grow up in the Hindu religion. I grew up in a church. But either way, like, if I was Hindu, I'd have been really mad. I still felt very offended. I was like, how are you going to take something that came out of... Like, there's no correlation here. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know who you think Kali is, but she has nothing to do with you. or white supremacists. Let's get this straight. But it's just like this bizarre solution for a very big problem.
Yeah. Well, it goes along with how people of color are treated in general when things like this happen. Mm-hmm. We're just told to suck it up, mm-hmm. or we're just told to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, mm-hmm. you know, but we don't have bootstraps to begin with, so.
Yeah, so do you think, Lenny, I'm going to ask you, because you're really smart and you read the news a lot and you have a lot of really good social perceptions and understandings, do you feel like you could separate, because I think oftentimes when we do go into therapy or some mental health space, we're expected to almost like separate the personal and the social. Do you think you could not let what's happening in society around you, seeing the discrimination that your community is going through and just the propaganda that upholds white supremacy, do you think that you can separate your personal life and not allow that to help affect your health?
No, for me personally, no. No, it's not possible, really. I mean, especially a person like me, like you said, I like to read the news and follow up on current events. I mean, this is on the front page of every newspaper, on every news site. You know, it's unavoidable right now, you know.
So have you ever gone into therapy and got a diagnosis for being depressed due to the world around you?
Well, no, not due to the world around me. And I think maybe that's part of the problem, you know, because I think when it comes to people of color, when we go into therapy, you know, it is a predominantly white field. And I think a lot of times mental health professionals, they just can't relate to how people of color deal with those feelings, you know.
I don't think they could even relate to how non-wealthy white people deal with those feelings. I don't think they could even help most white people a lot of times because I feel like a lot of times the solutions come from the ivory tower, you know. And I 100% believe in mental health care. I believe in therapy. I encourage everybody to go. How they're supposed to afford it, I don't know. That's another question. But I think it's amazing. Therapy changed my life. But I think we could do so much more. I think it could be a much more relevant service if we are willing to talk about it and challenge the institution. So hopefully that's what we'll do here. Yeah,
that's what this is all about.
All right. Any more current event issues we want to discuss, or do we want to move on? take the lead.
Well, I just, you know, like with this whole thing with these statues that, you know, are being removed, like I was just shocked to find out how many freaking statues there are to the Confederacy in this country. Like,
were they even? Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, to the losing side of the Civil War, there's statues all over the country. Like, you know, there's even statues in the Capitol of Confederate soldiers and Confederate generals in the Capitol.
The losers.
Yeah.
I mean, technically, they're traitors.
Yeah, they're traitors to our country. And then
they committed treason.
Yeah, and then I just wonder, like, what is it like for people of color, you know, African Americans especially, growing up in the South, to, like, everywhere you look, there's monuments to the people that wanted to enslave you. Mm-hmm. You know, like, how do you deal with that? Mm-hmm.
You know? Are there support groups for that?
Yeah, that's what I wonder. Yeah. You know,
it's yeah, that was very sobering. So I have no like quick, cute, funny thing to say in response to that. So I'm just gonna
pull them all down. That's what we need to do. Yeah,
I think that would be very cathartic. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, did you see that one? Where was that statue that there was a citizens' takedown of a statue?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Like that, and then they were like spitting on it and kicking it, and I mean, they were all white, which is like, you know, that is something white privilege affords you. Like, but at the same time, it is a white responsibility, so I'm glad they did it. But yeah, I think there'd be something very cathartic of just watching all of those monuments melt.
Yeah, definitely.
And build use it to build monuments of people who actually deserve. Mm-hmm. Who would you build a monument for? Which Americans, heroes, would you build monuments for?
I said we melt down all those Confederate statues, just build a big monument to Beyonce. Beyonce brings everybody together.
Okay, we're gonna write up a proposal for this. So we're gonna start a GoFundMe.
Contact your congressman.
So let's. You want to introduce our guest?
Okay. Yeah. I want to introduce our guest. Our guest today on our first episode of Color Therapy is Lance Tango. Lance Tango is a very experienced mental health professional, and he's going to talk about how mental health and social justice intersect, and how he, treats people of color.
So, Lance, you are a social justice-oriented psychotherapist.
Yeah.
Welcome, by the way.
Thanks. Nice.
Welcome.
To be
how
here.
Are you today?
I'm good. Yeah, it was interesting listening to the introduction conversation the two of you were having. Man, it's intense. Mm-hmm. These are intense times.
Yeah.
And I have some thoughts.
Can I interrupt you?
Yeah.
Before we move forward, you are a social justice oriented psychotherapist, which we thought was amazing. We were like, we have to have Lance as our first guest for our pilot. But a lot of people, including myself, it was the first time I heard that term.
Yeah.
So would you please explain to our listeners what that means?
Yeah, well, probably the reason it's the first time you heard it is because I'm the only one that really uses that.
But that explains it.
Yeah, it's such an important part of how I can conceptualize what mental health is. And so I am a psychotherapist by schooling and training. But I just don't see how to separate issues of people's experiences of either being oppressed or marginalized, discriminated against, subjugated, any of these things from how a person is going to conceptualize themselves and their well-being. Like those things seem to overlap so much. Mm-hmm. And the only reason that I really created this moniker of being a social justice oriented psychotherapist is to make a point that these two things belong together. Mm-hmm. It's not the assumption that I'm creating a new way of doing mm-hmm. therapy. I mean, if I am, great. That's not what I'm expecting. But it's more just to make a point okay. that these things actually, they belong together.
Nice. Absolutely. Yeah. Lance, can we ask where you're from?
So I'm from Southern California. My family is, I'm of Japanese ancestry. But yeah, I was born in Los Angeles and grew up between Orange County and LA pretty much my whole life. When you ask the question of where I'm from, though, you know, it's also informed by my ancestry, which is Japanese. My mom was born in a Japanese internment camp here in the United States. My dad comes from Hiroshima in the country, and he immigrated over here by himself when he was a teenager. Mm. And so all of those things also inform kind of where I'm from in a way. Mm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you mind? I just wanted to make a comment about something that the two of you were talking about earlier, about this idea of mental health. And it kind of, it was interesting. I think the word depression was brought up, and this idea of what's going on in the world and are we feeling depressed? And part of me thinks like, well, that's actually would be a healthy response to what's going on. Right? That
absolutely.
When we as people that come from communities that have been historically oppressed, for us to not be depressed, for us not to be anxious about that.
Some really good drugs you're on.
Right? Yeah, totally.
So, I want some of those. Tell me how to get that.
So it's even funny the way that we measure what mental health is, mm-hmm. right? Mm. There's, I think, a lot of mental health professionals that were error on the side of like, well, how can we just get you to feeling better despite the conditions of what's going on in this country right now, and that it actually affects you and it affects the community that you come from.
Right.
Like that disconnect seems actually more unhealthy to me.
Yeah, I'd have to agree.
Yeah. Well, that was my disappointment. When I would go to therapy, that was my disappointment. I felt like that all they were doing was pushing more and more medication on me to make me feel better. And then when that didn't work, it was just, you know, they would just up the dosage instead of actually addressing the problems.
Right.
And some of those problems are not fixable, you know, like some things are fixable. Like when I was in therapy, I learned I had a lot of really negative ways of seeing the world.
Sure.
And it was really fixable. I could learn different ways of viewing the world.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's this other issue that I'm a woman of color and every day I get treated like less than human and that affects me. I can't fix that.
No.
You know, I could work towards it, but I can't change the society that I live in.
Correct. Like
that. You know what I mean? So some things there's solutions for and there's other things that there just isn't.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think... And it might sound like I'm just taking down the whole field of mental health, and I'm not. I think I'm critical because I think there's so much potential there.
Right.
And if I had given up on the mental health field, I wouldn't even be having this conversation. Right. I'm having it because I think there's the possibility for growth and change within the field. And I think when mental health professionals are confronted with this reality that there are things going on in the world, and this client that's sitting in front of me, like, as a therapist, I don't know how to change society mm-hmm. and what's going on, but I feel a tremendous need to fix this. Mm-hmm. And so the only thing that I have that I can work with is this person in front of me. So right. I'm going to try and change their perspective instead of just meeting that client where they're at and mm-hmm. saying, you know what, your perspective on how kind of disappointing or upsetting the conditions are right now, politically or socially or whatever, like I can sit in that discomfort with mm-hmm. you, and I'm actually not going to try and talk you out of it.
Right.
But I think that takes a certain amount of courage mm-hmm. on the part of the therapist, because there is a surrender mm-hmm. to the fact that this world is filled with suffering and chaos mm-hmm. and power imbalances and all these other things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Now, like we were discussing earlier, that people of color may have a reluctance to go into therapy. Do you think, is there truth to that? And do you think that it's because of that reason, because they feel like maybe the therapist won't understand what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think, well, I think there is a reluctance in certain communities, be it communities of color or communities that have access to less financial resources, communities of certain religious beliefs and all of these other things. I think, yes, there is a reluctance in certain communities to seek out therapeutic services, mental health services. And I think it's part of it is based in what we were just talking about, what I was just saying about a therapist's inability to really meet the client where they're at in their reality and figure out a way to make peace with that within themselves as the therapist. I think the other reason is if we look at the history of therapy and the ways in which understanding the human psyche and the human mind, as with other medical endeavors, mm-hmm. have historically been used in a way to further perpetrate oppression against targeted communities.
How did that happen?
It happens because if we look at the history of any country, those in power, be it in this country for a long time, white folks, or if we look at, look, I'm Japanese American. If we look at the things that Japanese did when they were busy kind of destroying and colonizing and being imperialistic around all mm-hmm. the countries that surrounded mm-hmm. Japan, and we look at the ways in which people in power give themselves permission to understand human nature by experimenting on the people in which they have power mm-hmm. over as if they're animals or less than human. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, it's remarkable what human beings give themselves permission to do right. when they are in a position of power. Mm. It's remarkable. I mean, it's terrifying.
Right. So when we had a really good phone call like yeah. before when we were working this, and I remember you you gave me an example of how therapy entered much of the Black community in America yeah. and why there's a lack of trust in yeah. that relationship. Would you be open
yeah.
to discussing that?
Yeah, I think so. I think in terms of where things are today and therapy has been used this way in a while is oftentimes with the criminalization in this country of communities of color, how these communities are targeted always from a criminal justice perspective mm-hmm. as opposed to a public health perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can talk about how the strategies and the policies put in place when there was the crack epidemic. Mm-hmm. And we look at what's happening now with the heroin and opioid mm-hmm. epidemic mm-hmm. and how different that looks. Yeah. That one was approached from a criminal justice place. This is approached the opioid epidemic from a public health perspective right. because it affects white people.
Exactly.
No, right? So, exactly. And yeah. so what happens with mental health services and mental health professionals is they oftentimes, when serving communities of color, we oftentimes become an extension of the criminal justice system, of mm-hmm. law enforcement. There are so many clients that are mandated to therapy in order to either get their children back mm-hmm. or to get their sentence reduced to how much time they're going to spend in prison, or as a condition on their release of prison. And so they are then directed to different agencies that provide these quote-unquote mental health services. But those services and the people that are providing those services are really working from a place of how are we going to get this person to conform back into right. society, mm-hmm. as opposed to how are we going to address this person's trauma? How are you going to address this person's experiences of being targeted and oppressed and marginalized? It's more of a reprogramming. Mm-hmm. And prisons are meant to reprogram people mm-hmm. in a certain way. And I think mental health services that are provided in communities of color through this type of intervention, we just become a part of the criminal justice system. Yeah.
It sounds like an extension of slavery, basically.
It is.
Yeah. Treating people like like human chattel.
Basically. Yeah. And for me to convince you how to be okay with that, convince yourself that you should be okay with that, and actually learn how to better respond to authority in a way that it gives authority more control. Mm-hmm.
Can I share something?
Yeah, please. I'm just so serious, yeah. and I'm like, oh man, I'm just like bringing everybody in the room down. And
no, you're not. Actually, I think we're quiet because we're learning, and this is yeah. really fascinating. Like, yeah. I think honestly, I would say that sometimes people say it brings down the room. For me, it's so cathartic and freeing because you always feel like the fool or the loser or the monster in a society that's not made for you. So I feel that way. I have very low self-esteem, you know, even though I really work on it. I know intellectually that I'm no one's inferior because of my race. But experientially, I have low self-esteem. So when I hear this, and it helps, at least for me, it helps me understand myself more. So sure. For me, it's very cathartic. I don't feel like it brings me down. I think it gives me some hope for myself and for my community. So I love, this is very beneficial. I don't want to speak for anyone else. But for me personally, I'm appreciating it a lot. But this is something I want to share. Like, I was a domestic violence counselor for many years. And when you say it, it sounds very noble. You know what I mean? People are like, oh, wow. I worked in the shelters.
Sure.
And it's a hard job, and I'm glad that these shelters exist, don't get me wrong. But the shelter is very much a part of the institution, you know? And I used to feel like, it's a lot of what you said, like a lot of our clients, people don't understand domestic violence as how big of a situation it is. People often think of like this one crazy guy who assaulted his wife. That's not true. Domestic violence is extremely, it's as high as most developing countries in America as anywhere else.
Yeah.
But, you know, because of our beautiful white feminist system, we don't hear that story very much. And it's a very big thing. And it's very much to do with the courts, judges, economic disadvantage. You know, it's such a broad system. And a lot of our clients who would come in, they were brought in through social, different, you know, through child welfare or whatever it is. And they're forced to be there. And I think a lot of times the workers who decide, tell the clients they have to take the kid away from the home, I'm glad they do it. Because these men, a lot of them were incredibly scary. You know what I mean? Like, and they're women abusers too. We just dealt mostly with male abusers. But they're very scary. I'm not saying it's wrong that they say this, but there is a different targeting. I think black women are much more likely to be given a harsher sentence in that system than a victim. So I'm talking about victims.
Yes.
Than a white victim. You know what I mean? Because the court punishes victims, and you see all this. And part of my job as a counselor was to do clinical counseling. So sit there one-on-one, do counseling with the client. Then also on top of that, to do groups, support group, which both things are incredibly important. As much as I'm saying there's flaws with the mental health world, I do think it's incredibly necessary.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, I was a residential counselor. So as soon as a client comes in, they're given chores, which I hate that word because I think it's like something you tell children. So I don't know why we tell adults. I'm like, why not like community responsibilities or something? But from day one, they're given chores. And the justification is that it prevents depression because they have something to do, which I get. But I feel like if you just fled from home,
right,
you should at least get 3 days not to have to do chores. Like, that was my opinion in it. You know what I mean? So maybe I was always soft, but like, so, and every system is different. So I'm not trying to like bring down the system, but like, but this was something that was done, and it's good. Everyone who lives in the home should contribute. But I'm the same one that would give them the write-ups if they didn't complete their chores. I get it, someone has to do it. But because of budgeting, I was the same person doing the write-ups as the person providing the clinical counseling. Now, how do you trust the person who wrote you up yesterday? And you don't know why a person didn't do their chore. For me, I don't like to clean or cook, and I don't do any of that stuff. So, like, I do when I have to, but I won't do it every day. So I don't expect everyone to be able to do that every day, you know? But again, this place is functioning because we do all this. But then so if I wrote you up yesterday, how are you going to sit in a room with me today and tell me your deepest, darkest secrets and open up about the person? I became I used to joke, I used to call myself the popo. I was like, oh, I'm here. I'm going to write people. Like, I became the arm of authority.
Yes.
And I'm supposed to be like a source of compassion, you know, and I can't play both roles. And so there are certain clients who have a lot of life skills, and they come in, they could run the program, they could do everything. They were fine with me.
Right.
But clients who really came from the most disadvantaged backgrounds, they were the ones who didn't find any comfort in my presence.
No.
And I couldn't blame them. So
right.
when you're speaking, I'm like, this is like in every level. And then how is this client, if I'm talking too much, just stop me about this, how is this client supposed to trust a clinical environment when this is how they were introduced to it?
It's an impossible situation for everybody. You were put in an impossible position, and then the client therefore also is in an impossible situation. And that's the thing. That's right. That I think that is a perfect example of why people from certain communities have such a distrust of mental health services. And I think the role that you were put into is what happens when there isn't enough resources.
Mm-hmm. Not enough money. There wasn't
enough money.
It should have been two different workers doing that job, but we're not getting the funds.
Right. And not only that, if if really there was more money there, not only would it there be two different people playing that role, it's likely that that facility would have been, they would have had a staff to upkeep this, the place anyways.
Yeah.
I mean, if, I don't know if you all have ever visited a drug rehab place that's on the beach on the west side of town. But trust me, the people that are getting treatment there, they don't clean anything, mm-hmm. right? It's so, in what ways are, where are we putting our resources? Where, who gets the money?
Right.
And when people are in communities that don't get money, and then they're mandated to serve out these things for their betterment, mm-hmm. And instead are put into these impossible positions, it's no wonder that they feel like the mental health services is just not something that works, because mm-hmm. that doesn't work.
Right.
Yeah.
So what do we do? Reinvent the wheel?
Well, I mean, if I could reinvent the wheel, I would. There's a lot of things that right now in my mind that I wish I could change. But I don't know how to do most of those things legally, so I'm not even going to try. But I think one of the ways to do it, because I actually run a group in Watts for men that are mandated, and in that group, there's as many as 30 men in the room at any time. And the way that I do it is I start almost every day by having an explicit conversation about the ways in which this system is oppressing them.
Mm.
And so I don't... I'm just real with them.
Okay, got it. Mm-hmm.
And I don't... I explain to them that it's very likely that these men have a reason to be upset and angry. And that's where the conversation starts. Mm-hmm. And in historically, domestic violence treatment, the way that it works, is the first thing is to get the aggressor to admit the thing they did that was wrong. Mm-hmm. And I that's just not a priority to me.
Mm.
These men are mandated to be there for 52 weeks. At some point, if I'm doing this work in a way that it restores dignity and it creates a space where these men can connect and be vulnerable, then eventually over time, if somebody was truly an aggressor, because many of these guys pick up cases that these are bad cases. Mm. There wasn't even any domestic violence to begin with. But in those times when there was an aggressive act, over the 52 weeks, many of these people, they cop to it at some point and they own it. And the first thing that has to happen is by being honest. Like I have a responsibility to be honest with these mm-hmm. men. Because that's the only way that we're going to create a pathway toward dignity.
Mm.
And I think so many of the services that are provided in the mental health field to communities that are disenfranchised, there's no dignity in it.
Well, I think a lot of it is this idea that, I think wherever this research was being done and who these programs were created for, these ideas were created for, maybe they're not necessarily subjects that had all these extra,
yes,
you know, issues. Like if you're born into a very oppressed environment, you don't have as much control. You don't have a lot of control. So perhaps, you know, I think a lot of mental health care resources out there would work great for people who have everything great.
Yes.
Middle class family, you know, life skills, knowing how to budget, knowing the ability to overcome addiction. If you're kind of starting from that place, it's
right.
great. And I think a lot of your problems that you're creating in your own life comes from your sense of entitlement, sure, take
yes.
responsibility for your actions. Do this. That works great. Like, I'm not going to lie. I have some entitlement issues. And, like, a lot of basic self-help helps me with that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because, like, yeah, I'm American. I didn't haul water in the developing world like my mom. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
she saved
yeah.
me from that. I have some entitlement issues. So that's why I'm not going to say that stuff doesn't work or doesn't work. Because, sure, where I'm wrong, this stuff works great, you
right.
know? But in the situations that I have no control over, I don't feel like, you know, I don't know how much of a solution some of this, like, take control of your life and you're in charge of your feelings. Like, first of all, like, this whole idea you're in charge of your feelings, like, I don't know how my hormones within my body function. Like, I don't know when it's getting released. I don't know when glands release shit. I don't know. Is this a clean podcast? Can I I don't know when that's happening. I don't know how that works. I just learned what serotonin was when I was in college. I didn't grow up knowing what that was. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, what do you mean I'm in control of my feelings? Feelings are very biological.
Yeah.
And they're natural. They're responses. Like, I can't control, like, I don't even know what's happening in there. You know what I mean? Like,
correct.
How am I supposed to get complete control over all this? And so, I don't know. I'm going off on tangents now, but...
And I can go on for a while about this part of it, because the neurobiology behind all of this is also, it can't be ignored that when a child, an infant, a newborn baby, or even when it's still in vitro, like when it's when it hasn't even been born yet, that conditions that the mother is exposed to, the environmental conditions, and then the conditions that the infant is exposed to, all of those things start to have an impact on the subcortical areas of the brain, which is responsible, like it's the limbic system, the amygdala, all these parts of the brain that are responsible for emotionality, which is in place to help this being survive the world. When the conditions are harsh and chaotic, that part of the brain in that developing child who eventually becomes an adult, it gets attuned to be more sensitive to certain what is perceived to be as potential conflict or threats. And so the whole system within an individual, it's overly tuned in a way, right? And so, I mean, if we talk about justice and resources and what happens in disenfranchised communities, it goes all the way back to a developing brain for every child that grows up in these environments. And so this is huge. I mean, that's why I don't know how to solve any of these things. I just feel like until we are willing to have more honest conversations about these things, I don't know who's going to I don't see a group of people stepping forward and saying, look, we need to do something about this.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to what you said about restoring dignity.
Yeah.
Because, you know, because for people of color, you know, especially African Americans, you know, it's a daily thing where people are trying to strip away their dignity.
Yeah.
You know, it's on a daily, constant basis. So I wonder, like, if I'm an African American male, and I'm in this program with you, and I'm looking at you, and I'm like, okay, what's this Japanese dude gonna do for me?
Yeah.
So,
right.
So I wonder, like, how do you overcome that? How do you use their culture? Do you find commonalities between the cultures? How do you, you know, break that barrier?
Well, yeah, so
that's a good question.
It's a great question. I remember the very first. I've been running this group in South LA for over 2 years now, maybe almost three. And the first time I walked in there, I remember somebody in the group says, like, what do you know about us? Like, we didn't eat tofu for dinner last night. and I said to him, I said, how did you know I ate tofu for dinner last night? That's amazing. Right. And so I think working, allowing the assumptions about me that these men, they have a right to make them. And for me to not defend against them, but for me to let those assumptions be placed on me and to be like, okay, so you're probably right. This is who I am, and this is all the things you've heard about Asians are probably true, even though they're not. But let's just assume that's the case. It gives everybody in that room, including me, the challenge of how are we going to work our way through this together then?
Now you're in it together.
Now I'm in it with you.
So it sounds like you give up your power. It sounds...
Yeah.
It sounds like you're actively not... You know, not... We talk about giving up our power a lot in social justice communities, but I don't know how many of us know what that means even.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it's like an active exercise in giving up your power.
Yes. If I have to ask myself in my work, what are my priorities right now? Mm-hmm. Is it?
Yes.
Is my right?
Thank you. Yeah. Is your priority your pride?
Yes. Like, right. When I'm doing this work, my biggest priority is how can I connect with the person in front of me, mm-hmm. even if it means that I have to assume a position of either powerlessness or assume a position of being wrong. Or assume a position of not knowing what I'm talking about mm-hmm. and being labeled as whatever, that I will gladly take on and let that assumption be put on me mm-hmm. if it allows for the opportunity to possibly connect with this human being.
Right. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's a lot of the things you're seeing now with this whole explosion of suddenly people are getting involved in social justice situations that they never did before because we have a, you know, Nazi supporting fascist president.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of times, at least as a woman of color, like an intersectional feminist, a lot of the fighting that happens amongst feminists, like white feminists versus intersectional feminists,
yes.
is the goal gets missed. You know, we lose the goal. And then you'll have like, I'm sorry, I'm totally diverting it, but you'll have like a white feminist friend be like, but I'm not like that. And it's like, but no one's talking about you.
Right.
How do, you know, and the goal becomes me versus you and my feelings and who I am in this situation. As opposed to, okay, we have a fascist president. We all need to work together to take him down. Like, once we start putting ourselves into something,
sure.
you know, even with myself, when I would see clients, like, some of them used to be mean to me. Like, you don't retaliate. You don't be like, hey, listen, you know who I am? Blah, blah, you know what I mean? I used to have coworkers who'd do that. Like, I will not let a client disrespect me. And I'm like, but then why are you here?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, our clients are not here because they have everything together. They're here because society stripped them of a lot of things, you know? So how do you expect somebody who's here because they need support to act like a person who doesn't need support? You know, it's just such a bizarre, expectation that we have. And like, we want to, it's something we talked, I had a lot of friends, because I also worked in homeless services.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times the people we end up offering like support to that actually benefit from it, maybe it's the top 10% who might have done it without us anyway, but we just expedited their process.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Which is still great support to offer.
Absolutely.
I'm not against it.
Right.
But those are the ones who are benefiting the most because we come in with our own needs. We come in to be a savior.
Yes.
We want to be like, you know, I'm Asian American. I know there's a lot of problems. You know, I'm South Asian, with South Asian community being very oppressive to other minority groups, you know, in America. So I want to be the good South Asian.
Right.
Who, oh no, I'm beyond that. I get along with all the other people of color. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
I come in with a lot of my needs for identity. So I think sometimes with even practitioners, we come in with so many of our needs for our own personal identities to be fulfilled through our clients.
Yeah.
So it becomes about us and not our clients. So we can't really help them because, you know, and we have to think, like, why am I here? When you're a practitioner or you're a support staff, you're not there for your own gain. It's not a two-way relationship, you know?
I think it requires a lot of mindfulness and awareness about that and ownership. I do have to say one of the things that, and perhaps this is the way in which I try to level the playing field, even in my private practice when I'm sitting with a client, is at some point I let the client know that the work that we are doing together changes me also.
Mm.
And that there's something about their humanity and them allowing me to see their humanity through their vulnerability and their openness that I don't take that lightly, and that in fact it stays with me and it changes me. And I just don't know how many therapists are willing to be that transparent about because otherwise, if I don't reveal that, then the dynamics in that room, it's always one-sided, where the person that's sitting on my couch thinks, oh, I'm always going to be the deficient one in this room.
Right, right.
And I think it's important for me to reveal that, no, I have my own deficiencies also, and that something that we talked about just now, it addressed my own deficiencies and it changed me. Mm-hmm. And right, that's another way that I think I try to restore dignity in this whole process of mental health.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about giving up that power to restore your client's dignity. Is there anything else that a therapist can do when dealing with historically oppressed people? Like, what are other things that therapists miss when?
Yeah, I think the thing that therapists need to do, and I think most of them will not like me saying this, is I think it's important for people in the mental health field to understand history.
Yes.
And the history of the people they are working with.
Do some research.
Absolutely.
You have Google.
Right.
Come on.
Because when we take what is showing up as a collection of symptoms in this individual that's sitting in front of us and we put it in the context of their history, then all of a sudden that becomes a very transformative way to work. And that individual can see the ways that they are struggling, if that's what we want to call it, is actually, it's an outgrowth of the history that started before they were ever born. And so therefore, it's not even their fault.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I think it's important for us to know the history of the people that we work with, both their personal history and their ancestral history. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of this on my own.
You have to do your research.
Yes.
That person's a human being, not just...
Right. And to do our research not in how to be a better therapist, mm-hmm. but to do our research to better understand what it means to be a human being in this world.
Right.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, this is Lance Tango. Do you have a website or if someone is...
if you just Google Lance Tango,
not a lot of
you'll come across my stuff. You can look up Lance Tango Therapy. But yeah, just Google my name.
Thank you so much. This was so incredible, so informative.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah. And so we're going to move on to our third segment. She's been very quiet. We haven't heard her voice, but we would love to introduce you to Coach Chauncey.
Hi.
She is a certified life coach and an MFT intern.
Yes.
And she will be, so we have our third segment for our podcast is Listener's Letters. You guys are welcome to send us your questions if you'd like some advice, feedback, and Coach Chauncey will respond in the best way she knows how. This is our very first episode, so we actually got some questions from friends of ours, members of the community. They're anonymous. Mm-hmm. But we would like to share some with you. Is that cool? Oh, Chauncey, please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure.
I'm jumping the gun here.
We're just so excited
to be
here.
This is my first time.
Yes. So I'm super excited to be here, too. Thank you guys so much. I joke, there's really no such thing as a certified life coach, but I got my certification in life coaching. So, I mean, hey, I'm going to use the title. But I am also doing my MS in counseling. And as some people out there probably know, it takes a lot of hours. So I'm in the process of doing that. And I just really enjoy helping others and listening to people. And so when approached with the idea about doing a listener letters portion, I was super excited. And we put out the notice to our community to see if we were to host a podcast, what kind of questions would you want to ask? So do you have questions about friendship, life, love, anxiety, stress, being a human being on planet Earth, all of that stuff. And we got some really cool responses. So I'm excited to hear some of them.
Yeah, okay. So let's get started. We have our first listener letter here. And it goes, "Hi, I'm in a field that still discriminates against POC a lot, and there are very few opportunities for us. Although most of us work together and help each other, there is a clique of opportunists. They use ass-kissing and exaggerating their successes and showing off to move up. They constantly throw other POC under the bus to elevate themselves."
For anyone who doesn't POC, people of color.
Yes. "I used to ignore them, but now I see that they really are getting all the limited opportunities for POC in the field, and it's making me bitter. I don't like feeling like this. How do I witness this every day and not become bitter?"
Such
That's an amazing question.
And I really liked that because Raja and I, we're friends outside of the podcast, obviously, and we've talked a lot about this, especially in our friendship over the years as well. So how do you, as a person of color, in an industry that is being dominated by non-POC, rise up, still feel like you are, like, making your mark and doing what you want to do, but not also, like, be cognizant of other people whose opportunities you guys, like, might be taking? I feel like that was one jumbled sentence, but you guys, I was trying to say.
We're following you.
You guys heard the letter. And one thing that I heard from this letter was that you're growing bitter. And I think that was the biggest thing that stood out to me, was the emotion behind the experience that you're having. And to that, I just want to commiserate with you, because I do understand what that's like. And I don't want you to feel bitter about it, because in fields where there are limited opportunities, there is some ass-kissing that you do have to do. There is some exaggerating of your success. I think we can all agree that in any field that you're in,
It sucks, but it's true.
Especially
in our field.
Entertainment.
Yeah. Yes, entertainment.
That's how we got here.
Right. And so no matter, that's how we got here. but it's true.
Lenny did a lot of sexual favors to get us this game.
That's so what happened. Producer's like, why are we talking about this?
I pimp him out all the time for opportunities.
But look where it got us, okay? But I think there is that element to every job, and it is being stretched and exaggerated towards you because you also have this added element of being a person of color and seeing the limited positions that are available for you and for other people. So I just want to encourage you that ass kissing is a part of it. However, it's not okay to throw other people of color under the bus. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And if those opportunities are being taken away from you personally because of those things, that's something that it's kind of hard because I don't know what field this person mm-hmm. is in. But those are things to address with a superior, I believe, because a superior isn't necessarily going to see you as a person of color. And I want you guys to hop in too, because mm-hmm. this is just my opinion and we all have very different experiences with this. So I definitely wanted this to be more of a community conversation because I'm speaking from my field. Mm-hmm. My boss, I don't believe, sees me as a person of color mm-hmm. first. And so if I were to come to her and say, hey, this was my idea, this was my project, X, Y, and Z, I would be listened to mm-hmm. in that sense. So being able to kind of stand up for yourself and to try not to, I want to be very careful with my words because being a person of color is part of it. But I think a huge part of our experiences is that a lot of times we see everything through that one lens mm-hmm. and it limits us. It encloses us it consumes us. That's all Absolutely. We see. But there's this whole other mm-hmm. section to that. Mm-hmm. What are your guys' thoughts about this situation?
Well, unfortunately, that's a big problem because with people of color, because there are so limited opportunities, mm-hmm. when we see another person of color in the same field, we see them as competition.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we see them as like, we get this feeling of like, there can be only one. He's mm-hmm. coming to take, he or she is coming mm-hmm. to take my spot.
My spot.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's something, you know, the lack of opportunity is something that we don't have a lot of control over. Mm-hmm. So then that's when the bitter feelings come in. You know, it's not really about that other person. It's mm-hmm. about the bitterness towards the lack of opportunities.
Yeah, agreed.
I think, I could say for entertainment in this world that we're in, the comedy and acting, I think I struggle with that a lot, you know, because I felt, especially as comedians, mm-hmm. people of color who were willing to kind of do the Apu act. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I saw them coming up so fast and it was really upsetting me. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes there's a group and they're not progressive. They're not here for the whole community. It's like a lot of, and maybe that's my perception. I don't know. But it felt that way to me. I was like, okay, they're taking the brand. They're branding this woman of color or South Asian, like they're branding it and we're all part of this community. Right. Who are you to brand it?
Right.
And it used to really keep me up late at night and I would get so angry and I felt like I was very, you know, marginalized even in South Asian community because I'm still from a minority group within that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one thing that really empowered me a lot was to say, okay, but then I'm also falling into this thing of seeing myself under only being able to succeed as a South Asian entertainer. And I thought, you know, and the best thing, and I still struggle with it, I'm not gonna lie, it's really hard for me, but the best thing that's helped me stay healthy and move forward was like, why am I trying to work within the system? Let me come up with some really new creative ideas that nobody else has. This certain group of people can keep me out. They could take all whatever. If you could take all the Apu opportunities you want. I'm not Apu and I'm not doing that act.
Right.
You know, I'm doing something completely different. I do my research. I'm smart. I keep up with the trends.
Right.
And I'm a really unique, creative art. I'm an artist. I'm different and I don't have to compete.
Exactly. Being empowered mm-hmm. about the situation is definitely very important. Knowing who you are and what you bring to the table is very important. And we've talked as well about kind of playing smart. Mm-hmm. I think in our culture, a lot of brown people's culture, we are people of color, I would say, we've been taught these values that are always kind of like, keep your head down, keep steady, you know, just keep doing what you're doing.
And don't get attention from anyone.
Yes, eventually someone's going to see your hard work, and that's just not the world that we live in right now. And we have to shed those ideas
sometimes
to get to where we want to be.
Work too hard, doing good labor, you'll never get promoted because who would replace you?
Right. It's very replaceable work that you're doing if it's just consistent. Yeah. So you got to break out a little bit. And so maybe do some brainstorming, see what kind of ideas that you can pitch, ways that you can shine in your own light, and work towards that instead of working against the other people.
So I hope we have time. I want to ask.
Do one more?
Can we do one more? We wouldn't do one more because it's very relevant right now. Do you want to do it?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so here's our next listener letter. My brother is a Trump supporter.
So the brother is obviously, I'm assuming, a person of color who's a Trump supporter.
There's more.
That's enough. Let's talk about this for 2 hours. What do we do to help this poor person?
So it continues. I found out because my son came home saying some racist thing he learned from his cousin, who is my brother's daughter. I no longer want my son to go over to his uncle's house. He is very close to his cousin. Is it wrong for me to take him away from him?
From her.
From her, excuse me.
Yeah.
That's tough.
I'm sorry,
that's
Trump
so
supporter
tough.
Sister. It's so sad. Wow. I believe that we make a lot of excuses for our family members. And you have to ask yourself, Trump supporter sister. I don't want to call you that. Social justice sister.
The good sister.
Yeah,
the good.
I want to ask you to ask yourself, if your child was on a sports team where there was racist language being spoken, would you allow your child to still participate on that team? If your kid was in a daycare facility or being babysat by someone else who was using this type of language around your child, would you allow your kid to like stay in that environment? And you kind of have to translate that to your family. Yes, it is your brother, but your main responsibility is to provide a supportive, socially conscious environment for your child. And if your child is not getting that at your brother's house, your kid can't be at your brother's house anymore. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the cousins can't hang out. You know, bring the cousin over to your house most of the time, take the cousins out. You know, that relationship is very important. But primarily, you've got to make sure that your kid is being fed the right things spiritually, emotionally, consciously, and that's just not happening at your brother's house. And I would say probably your brother's going to ask questions about why your kid isn't over there that much. And I don't know what kind of relationship you have with your brother, but if you're not trying to ruffle feathers or whatever, I'm not trying to say, like, start a brawl, even though I wouldn't be opposed.
It's like,
starting
a rivalry.
But I would say keep it about your kid and keep it about the experience that you had. So you heard something racist come out of your son's mouth.
It just must have been so horrible.
Oh, my gosh.
Must have been so horrible.
Awful. Absolutely awful. And keep it about that, and keep it about the outcome that you see for your son and how it's not aligned with the environment that your brother is providing for him.
You know, sometimes we have principles about family, right? Like, I grew up in South Asian community. Family is just so important. Yeah. And I felt like I had a toxic family member that my mom never took me away from because she wanted me to have cousins so badly, you know, especially because we're immigrants. We didn't have, well, I'm not immigrant. My mom, you know, immigrated here. I was born here. But we didn't have the whole, all the relatives and stuff in this country. But I think sometimes, like, that's the thing with having principles, right? We forget what's even our personal priority.
Right.
So it's so easy to just say family and you forget that. But the reason why you want your kids to have families is for their quality of life.
Right.
So if the family's taking away that quality of life, are we really even accomplishing what we intend to accomplish by having them around family?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I'm an only child, so I can't relate to any of that. So I'm just like, fuck your brother, fuck your sister, take care of your own shit.
But you have
a balance,
But you have relatives.
Yeah, I do have I do have relatives, and for that reason, I tend not to hang out with them. So that's what I'm saying, yeah.
I think the heart of the matter, too, is the closeness of the cousins. She seems very preoccupied with that relationship, and that relationship can still stand and can still flourish, just not at your brother's house. I mean, there's other places for
and age makes a difference in this situation.
It does, it does. So if, you know, the kids are older, he has a lot more agency, and you can talk to him about, oh, what are your thoughts about this situation? And so if the kid is younger, though, that's a whole other thing. They're not able as much. You know, they're very impressionable. Kids are, they're going to absorb what they hear. So taking care of that early on is great. And it's awesome that this question was even asked, because it shows she's already being proactive. So great.
Yeah. All right.
So that's our very first. Thank you, everyone, so much for being here. Thank you, Lance Tangle.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
It is amazing to have you. Incredible. Coach Chauncey, you're incredible. She will be here with us every week. And again, my name is Roger Michael.
And I'm Lenny Shelton.
This is Color Therapy, a mental health podcast for people of color.
Pilot.
This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.